is right.
Do I need this?
It has to do with the black people having things around their necks. And their feet off the ground and all that sort of thing. All right, my remarks will be vague enough that questions will be impossible. But I'm told that we shall leave some time for questions. I want to do one thing very quickly, and this will give you some frame of reference for the things that I will say that you will understand. And by the way, these remarks will in no way provide you with any information about what I do here. That is, there's no information involved in what I'm saying. It's just impressions. And living in Champaign-Urbana, most of what you get is impressions. I'd like you all to if you look at yesterday's paper, there is an article about Knox College abandoning innovation. Today's Daily Illini, there's on page 3, there's an article which conveys an interview by the new president of the university. I would urge you to read that. For had you all read that, we wouldn't have to be here today, you see. So check it out. Let's begin with a few quotes. John Gardner said, "Nothing can be more readily disproved than the old saw that you can't keep a good man down." Most human societies have been beautifully organized to keep good men down. Ben Bloom said, "Aptitude is the amount of time required by the learner to attain mastery of a learning task." Implicit in this formulation is the assumption that, given enough time, all students can conceivably attain mastery of a learning task. And Shubidoo said, "Has history asked too much of us at such an early age?" And the Talmud says, "If not now, when?" And the Bible says, "How can we sing a song of Zion in a strange land?" All right? Now, if you can deal with that, I can stop. But in fear that you cannot deal with that, we shall press on. And we sat in the union, the student and I, and I said to this student, "Younger brother," I said, "Younger brother, you come from a long, long line of black folk who have survived many things. You come from black folk who have survived such things as the middle passage and the lash and the rope and the hose and the cities of despair and the dead, unyielding land and all the shit that America has put on us." And Dickie can handle that. You come from a long, long line of black folk who have often bent but have seldom broken. And I said, "Younger brother, you come from a long line of black folk who has loved and served this terrible country and a lot of other things." And I said, "Surely, younger brother, you can survive the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana." So he got up, he got his books, and he split. And I think he felt a little better. And he went off, he made this class one more time, and he did it again one more time. So then I got up, and I hurried across the quadrangle, and it was very cold that day. I hurried across the quad in that brisk November to another meeting of a committee of gentlemen and scholars who were very busily plotting that black student's destruction. And then there's a song that goes, there's a line in the song that goes, smiling faces sometimes tell lies. Smiling faces, sometimes they don't tell the truth. Now the clearest and most present danger of speaking to groups like this is the danger of being misunderstood or of being not understood. But that risk, I think, is assumed by all black folk who talk to white folk and vice versa. And the risk is a part of the action. But I think it's very important, and I think we do it because we aren't sure what else to do. And I think part of that fear, that risk, is involved in the strange values that black folk give to things and the way we have of ignoring certain things. So I decided some time ago, and I decided this about once a month, that I will not talk to large groups of white folk anymore. Once a month I decide that. Especially educated white folk. Because I think it has to do with the European tradition. Something has happened to white folk who have gone to European schools. It has affected their ability to listen and to hear. But those dangers come with the territory. I mentioned a little while ago, as they were eating, that when I came down here to look into this operation, many, many years ago, years and years ago, 3 years, 4 months, 22 days ago, the first meal I had was in this room. I was brought from the airport into this room. Hope that my last meal will not be in the same place. One of the dangers of talking about black students in higher education is that too many times these talks, these presentations become raps. They become rather presumptuous and excessive rhetorical assaults on institutions or attempts to clarify the morass that higher education seems to be. Other times, the discussions pretend to examine the curricula in higher education, and that's impossible. Or to criticize the institutions, or to talk about institutional racism in America, or racism in higher education, and all that stuff. Well, most of that's been talked to death. I was wondering last night, whatever happened to those people I met in the early fall of 68, the people of CRJ, for instance. I was wondering where they are, where are they now? So the talk, you see, has become a replacement for action. That is, it's easy to talk about minority students than to work for them. It's easy to talk about them than to create viable programs on their behalf. We have found that so. It's easier to talk about them than to make the white campus livable. And what we're seeing now is the rather sad end of a rather charming and romantic interlude between higher education and the minorities of America. Because this interlude has somehow generated a great many rather vague and clever notions about students in higher education. And these are students we're talking about who have survived the communities and the conditions which were created by the alumni of this institution. So when I talk about the university, I'm not talking about this university. I'm talking about the idea of a university, and not in the Numenian sense either, in a much more, I hope, relevant notion. Anyway, when I was first asked to speak to the group, my first response is always, no way, or I've done that. But I've decided that I knew, of course, that an invitation from Nancy Simon or the Y or the YW or Ed Nestigan is not really an invitation at all, but it's a kind of a general command. And I accepted it primarily because there's no place on this campus or in this town where black students are as well-received and as graciously supported as they are in this place. And we owe the Y some debts that they don't know anything about and which they probably will never collect on, at least not here. So you see, the problem with this presentation is the impossibility of saying anything that you haven't heard before, or saying something that will somehow affect any of your opinions, or the way you view the world, or the way you view my job, or the way you view your own job. And I wish I could somehow say something that would move someone to act to do something. But since we've learned that action is very expensive, we'll talk about the problem. And we try and we keep on trying because you see, that contrary to what our enemies keep telling us, failure is for us is only a pause on the way on our way to where we're going to be. So unless you wonder about the question raised in that title, the university, should everyone be the same? I can dispose of that in one word, in two words. No way. The temptation, of course, is very great to verbalize this. For me, the temptation is very great to verbalize the many daily frustrations we have. But I have long since discovered that even white folk don't enjoy getting rapped at anymore. And that's a waste of time anyway, a waste of your valuable time. So I want to share with you some impressions, nothing but impressions. And these impressions are not all mine, but they're impressions shared with me by people across this country who do what we do, by the many black and white administrators of programs like ours. And I might add that if there appear to be criticisms in these remarks, they are not all necessarily aimed at this place. Without getting involved in any unnecessary encomia, the University of Illinois looks pretty good, but as Sister Roberta says, but compared to what? And we could tell some stories, but we won't. One of those stories, of course, would be how the academy went from concession to consensus and ignored the intervening step called commitment. And that takes some doing. Or we could talk about the rather curious betrayal of many black administrators by placing them in positions in which they were probably likely to fail, without giving them the kind of support which they would need to succeed. That's another story, too. Now, I don't speak for the black majority students, because I've learned that they speak too well for themselves. I want to talk about the academy, and I won't, I'm sure, add to the plethora of assaults on the institutions. I won't mention any of the exaggerations about the decline and fall of the academy, or the retreats from excellence, or the decay and disorder in higher education. We needn't talk about that. That's been done to death. It's been done by scholars and by liars, and I think as far back as 59, Barzun talked about it, and Veblen rapped on it, and Nisbet and other folk, and we needn't mention that new crew of pedagogical pimps from out of the East, where all good things come from, like guys like Holt and Goodman and Kozel, who have gotten fat and famous and rich by assaulting the academy, primarily, again, because it's easier to talk than to act. So most of what I say about majority students in higher education may not apply to Illinois to the same extent that it does elsewhere. And I think it's one of the more recent insults, it's one of the more recent historical insults to black people that they have arrived at the cities at the point in history when they became uninhabitable and unmanageable, and they have arrived at the institutions in about the same time. That is, the academy is now besieged by naysayers and prophets of doom and high costs and reductions of staff and budgets and the faltering public confidence and all kinds of internecine conflicts between the newer and the older faculty and conflicting pedagogies and federal and state policy confusions and lowered status and staff morale. We should open the Senate meetings to the student body so they could see the pall that falls in that place when the meetings are called. So imagine, if you will, if you can, the impact of this apparent confusion on students for whom this place was not designed in the first place. Imagine the feeling of how the feeling of disorder here affects the learning process, the growing process, among students who have never believed that they were welcome here in the first place. The university, at least, yeah, the idea of the university is very unclear. I think the university appears to suffer from something which I like to call the absence of, presence of function. Or maybe the university is having an identity crisis. The professoriate, you see, on whom we base our hope, or at least we used to, has other things to worry about now. Consider, if you will, the fact that a faculty which considered student strikes on moral issues unethical would consider striking for money. The students are dumb, but they're not crazy. And the faculty has to consider its salaries and its publications and its research and its tenure and its status. And from time to time, it has to look at, and every now and then it has to think about teaching. You see, the academy was designed to select out the gentlest and the best and the noblest minds, and to insulate those minds and to protect them from the outer and the lower world. And the academy was designed to nurture those minds and then graduate them so that they could continue the process. Now we're finding the academy assaulted by people for whom it was never intended in the first place. This institution, Illinois that is, like all such institutions, has a history and tradition of elitism, which is apparently in very serious conflict with emerging demands on its resources. And these demands are coming from all sorts of places, from the community, which has been so long neglected here. And much of the trauma the university is suffering from is in part due to these assaults on its institutional ego, which is apparently much more fragile than we thought it was at first. Scholars and students come to these places, primarily to think and to read and to meditate and to understand and to program the world. They do not come here to change it. And I would urge all of you to read very carefully the remarks of the president and the Daily Illini for today. It's very important. It's crucial that you understand that. Understand it in the same sense that the people I work with understand it. The whole myth of the land-grant tradition, you see, that whole business of the Morrill Act was never intended to be taken seriously. When they talked about land-grant institutions, they were talking about the landed gentry, not just anybody. The school didn't belong to the people. It belonged to the people who owned the land. The function of the academy in America is to perpetuate the culture. It has no other purpose. The function of the academy is to perpetuate the European tradition. It has no other function. And to the extent that it does or does not do that, it is a failure. So say my enemies. And I think in part the cause of this sense of betrayal, and in some ways frustration of those who would like to alter those directions, is a function of our failure to realize and to accept the European tradition in which the institution is to which it's geared. We fail to estimate, to understand, how deeply rooted in the European tradition the academy was. And today we suffer from our naivete. But we learn from it also. Life would be much simpler if we could all somehow agree on what the university should be about. It would be simpler. It would be simpler It really would if everyone were the same. Life in the academy would be simpler and more pleasant. And it was when students and staff and administrators accepted the single and narrow definition of what the academy was supposed to do. Or what was the role of the university in to provide the nation with the right kind of leadership? The right kind of leadership. Much of the difficulty in defending the academy from assaults, of course, from the right and the left and the radical middle, is the result of our disagreement and the apparent confusion over what are, in fact, the true and noble and attainable goals of the academy. In the past, the institution was allowed to determine who was worthy of entrance, who was worthy of higher education. That is no longer quite so. We all support, I believe that most of the majority in America, the ethnic majority that is, support the notion of higher education. I'm pretty sure we do. Because there are skills here that we will need, I believe we do. And we share a commitment to an admittedly very vague notion of higher education. We do accept it. At one time, back in the early 60s, middle 60s too, I suppose, we hoped for much more than just a training for our kids. We hoped for change. And that was a long time ago. Because we dreamed that change was possible because it was necessary. We believed, as we had been taught in the white schools that produced us, that anything in America that is necessary is possible. We believed, or we pretended to believe, that if we could somehow introduce to the institutions the black, the Latin, the Chicanos, in great enough number, that they, in fact, would change the direction of the institution. We believe that. We believe they could do this by virtue and by force of their numbers, then their need, and their enthusiasm. Schools throughout this state, as you all know, have been told, they've been asked, they've really been told, to review their programs and to establish what the board calls new priorities, which in fact amounts to, we can read that as a reinstatement of the old priorities. Colleges and departments and units are right now being asked to re-examine their ability to be innovative and to be creative. You've been told that anything that does not provide the kind of direction the university must go in has to be cut out. Add to that the crush for spaces in the freshman classes is going much more acute. The number of those students who are said to be highly qualified, or those students for whom this university was first intended, the numbers are increasing greatly. And I think the fact that the federal government has said that it can no longer support, in the ways that it has in the past, higher education creates other problems for the majority student. The money is, in fact, drying up. And the new rationale you see among the professoriate is that perhaps the university is not for everybody. And my response, of course, is always, that may be true, but perhaps everybody is not for the university. There are still some of us who hope rather desperately that the integrity of the university will somehow come to match its corporate greatness and its statistical importance, that somehow the university's ego will come in line with its function. Such hope persists, I think, in spite of much evidence to the contrary, all across the country, where once again you see hearing expressed concern of many people who feel that the academic integrity of this institution is somehow being compromised and jeopardized and prostituted by admissions of persons who may not belong here. And it's been 3 years since I heard that. The reaction to our work is becoming much more visible and much more active. And they're now talking in terms of culture shock and culture lag and compromised standards. And I don't know what any of that means. But there must be a sociologist here who can explain it to me. Such persons who believe that those of you who are concerned about the university being assaulted can rest assured that there are people in the offices of admissions and in the offices of the deans and clerks and secretaries and department chairmen who are ever vigil, ever constant, on guard at the gates of the temple to assure that the unworthy will not enter the temple. There are people here who have dedicated their lives to seeing to it that the great unwashed will never befoul this land. And they do so at the command of administrators and faculty who are cautious not to do it themselves, lest they be considered educational reactionaries. In closing, I'd like to say that I think we are right and they are wrong. And I also think that our kids are going to win, primarily because they're right. And they're going to win for us. And they're going to win on this campus, and I think they'll win everywhere else. And it is not that they will win because of the numbers or because of commitment, but because they have to win, because we have no choice. And it isn't about genocide either. It's just about staying alive. And we expect these kids will vindicate the faith and the trust we have in them, because they're really good. They really are. I do not know what the University of Illinois ever did to deserve the presence of these kids on this campus. I have no idea. But they're going to vindicate, I believe, the faith and the confidence of those who recruit them and who admit them and who counsel them, and especially those who teach them. And they shall learn a lot. And they're going to learn, I think, their most important lessons from those people who hate them most. Because those are the lessons you see that they won't forget. They will forget the dates and the formulae and the remedies, but they won't forget that. And in the course of their forgetting, they're going to expose the test makers, data collectors, and the researchers. They're going to expose the Jensens and the Shockleys and the Stanleys and some of your friends and neighbors. And they're going to survive this place, and they're going to become teachers and doctors and lawyers and accountants and ministers and artists and architects and professors and deans and dreamers. And they're going to become poets, and they're going to become prophets, and whatever else comes out of places like this. They're going to become liars and fools. Whatever this university generates, we will inherit all of that. And even in the cases of those whom we don't succeed in educating, I think, because the failure, you see, is always ours, even those persons who don't survive this experience can always become sociologists or psychologists. And in that way, you see, they can explain why they didn't succeed. They will not only survive in the university, in the academy, but they shall even survive these cultural and ethical deserts in which these universities place themselves. And that may be the most serious challenge. You see, these students are one of the great contradictions in the history of higher education and in the history of America. That is, they are the great contradiction of the European educational tradition, in that they have learned to cope and to function and to survive. And hopefully, as they go through this maze, They will develop the kind of inner strength that is required of a trip through academe. And hopefully when they graduate, they will then be prepared to deal with the kinds of contradictions that remain for them and for all black people in America. And we know they will succeed because they told us so. Thank you. I'd like to make a question.
Just if you'll just stay for a minute, please.
Okay. See there?